Journey to Topaz by Yoshiko Yoshida. Chapter 3. A Lonely Christmas. For 5 long days there was no word from Father. All during the day Mother waited for a phone call, and each night she left the porch light on. But Father neither came home nor called. It was the same at Mr. Atoa's house, and at Jim Hirai's house, and every other home where Father had been taken by the FBI. No one knew where the men were, or even whether they were alive and well. Mr. Toda called each day to ask if Father had returned, and one day he walked all the way to their house from the church dormitory in Oakland. He explained that he had done it for the exercise, but they knew that he was also trying to save the car fare. He whispered to Mother when he thought Yuki wasn't listening. "It is rumored," he said ominously, "that the men were..." Page 20. "Taken as hostages, that they may be harmed if Japan kills any more Americans." Yuki shuddered at the horror of the idea and was angry with Mr. Toda for even mentioning it. Mother was worried enough as it was. Yuki stalked out of the house, brushing past the old man without saying a word and whistling for Pepper. Pepper licked Yuki's face, wagging his tail and whimpering softly as though to console her. Even the big gray carp came swishing up to the surface of the pond, opening his mouth wide to make Yuki laugh. It was as though they knew the sadness and fear that troubled her, and were trying to give her some cheer. Animals really were much nicer than people, Yuki thought. They never said things that could make you sad. She thought about how red-haired Garvis, who sat opposite her at school, the day after the Pearl Harbor attack, had leaned over and hissed, "You dirty Jap!" Yuki was so angry she had shrieked back, "I am not! I am not a Jap, I am an American," and she didn't care who hurt her. Miss Holt had stopped writing on the blackboard and had stated then and there to the entire class that the Japanese born in America, the Nasai, were just as American as anyone else in the school. They must never be confused with the Japanese militarists who attacked Pearl Harbor, she explained. "The Nasai are good and loyal citizens," she added emphatically, "just as you and I." She brushed the chalk dust from her hands and looked straight at Garvis as she spoke. That made Yuki feel a little better, but she could never forget what he had said. "I hate you, Garvis Dickerson," she thought bitterly. It was a... Page 22. Good thing there were people like Mimi Nelson and Mrs. Jameson to make up for the Garvises of the world. Mrs. Jameson lived all alone and had a bad leg that gave her pain and headaches. But Yuki had never heard her say a cross or unkind word to anyone. On the 6th day after he was taken away, a postcard finally arrived from Father. He told them that he was being held at the Immigration Detention Headquarters in San Francisco and asked for his shaving kit and some clean clothing. "Am safe and well," he wrote, "and pray that you are too." "Thank goodness," Mother sighed as she read it. It was not knowing where or how he was that had been the worst part of the long wait. In a few more days, Father wrote that they could come to San Francisco to visit him, and he hoped to see them soon. The very next day, Ken and Yuki stayed home from school, and Ken drove them in the family car to San Francisco. Mother told him that while Father was away, he was free to use the car as his own. Ken nodded absently. Any other time, he would have been overjoyed to have the sole use of the car. But now there was little pleasure in the privilege. He drove silently over the Bay Bridge and scarcely spoke until they reached the immigration headquarters. Yuki didn't like the look of the building. Somehow, all government buildings seemed austere and unfriendly, smelling of stale cigar smoke and cleaning fluids. She disliked this one more than most and hated the thought of Father being held there like a prisoner. They waited for him in a small, dark room. And when he came in, followed by a guard, he looked tired and worn. Father, who never left the house without a neat crease in his trousers and a, page 23, black bow tie at his neck, was tieless and rumpled, still wearing the gardening clothes in which he had been taken. He tried to be cheerful, however, and told them that everything was fine. "Most of my friends are here," he explained. "There are over a hundred of us, all sleeping on cots in one big room. It's like a college dormitory." "Sounds more like jail than college," Ken said darkly, but Father ignored his remark. "Are you getting enough to eat?" Mother asked anxiously, "and are you able to sleep?" "What do you do all day anyway?" Yuki asked. Father answered all their questions patiently and asked many of his own. He wondered if they were getting along all right without him. "Do you have enough money? Have you been able to withdraw money from my account at the bank?" "Be sure to get that car lubricated this month, Kenichi," he reminded Ken. It was only when their short visit was coming to an end that Father told them that he was among a group of 90 men being sent to an army internment camp in Missoula, Montana. "Montana?" Mother gasped. "When do you leave?" Ken asked, trying to keep his voice steady. "In a few hours," Father said. "I'm glad we had this chance to say goodbye." Yuki was too stunned to say much, but "Montana's miles away," she said, her voice rising. "We won't be able to visit you." Father nodded. "Not for a while, Yuki-chan, but I'll be back soon. Take good care of yourself now, and Kenichi, look after your mother and sister for me. Be careful in every way." Page 24. Father hugged each of them silently and left the room quickly without turning back. Yuki tried to blink back the tears, but she couldn't keep them from streaming down her face. "Oh, Mama," she squeaked, crying on her mother's shoulder, just as she used to when she was a small child. Mother held her close for a moment and then rose from her chair. She dabbed at her eyes and pulled on her gloves and straightened her hat. "Well, we mustn't just sit here the rest of the day," she said in a tight voice. "Come, Yuki, Kenichi, let's go home and fix up a package to send your father in time for Christmas." Ken took Mother's arm and held it until they had reached the car. He helped Mother in and even gave Yuki a hand as she climbed in. Instead of making her feel better, however, Ken's gentleness only made Yuki sadder. Father was gone, and Ken was trying hard to take his place, but they all knew he never could. And when would they ever see Father again? It was a few days later that Ken made an announcement at supper time. "I'm leaving school, Mom," he said matter-of-factly. "Leaving the university?" Mother asked. "But why?" "Most of my friends are leaving," Ken explained quickly. "The guys who live in Brawley and San Pedro and Los Angeles are all going back to help run the farms and businesses their fathers had to leave when they were interned. Besides," he added, his face suddenly growing stern, "everybody says there's going to be an evacuation." "A what?" Yuki asked. Ken looked at Mother, although it was Yuki who had asked. Page 25. The question. "They say the government is going to move all the Japanese from the West Coast," he explained. Yuki nearly choked on her lamb chop, and Mother coughed into her tea. "Don't be foolish, Kenichi," Mother scolded. "Why would the United States ever do a thing like that? We are not spies or traitors. And besides, you children are American citizens. You were born right here in California. How could they do anything like that to citizens?" Ken shrugged. "There are a lot of people in California who'd be very happy to be rid of the Japanese competition in business and on the farms. They'd be glad to see us leave. It's people like that who spread those false rumors about sabotage in Hawaii when there wasn't any at all." Ken's face was flushed and his voice was rising. He could get pretty steamed up about anything that he thought was unfair or wrong. Mother tried to quiet him. "People can get hysterical when they're afraid, Kenichi," she explained. "Fear sometimes makes people do terrible things." "But why should we be victims of their stupid fears?" he asked bitterly. Even Mother couldn't answer that. Ken thought the talk of an evacuation was more than a rumor, but Yuki couldn't believe him. How in the world could they ever gather up all the Japanese in California and shift them somewhere else? Where would they go? What would happen to all their homes? It was an impossible idea. "You're crazy," she said to Ken. Page 26. But Ken said ominously, "You just wait. You'll see whether I'm crazy or not." Christmas was bleak and drizzly, and not even the burning logs in the fireplace lent much cheer to the general gloom. There was no Christmas tree this year, for they decided it wouldn't be right to celebrate this wartime Christmas when men were fighting and dying in the Pacific, and Father was interned in a prisoner of war camp in Montana. Mother did bake her Christmas cookies as usual, however, and packed some in a red tin decorated with holly to send to Father. They packed nuts and candy and dried fruit as well, and put everything in a big carton, along with some wool socks and caps and mittens, for the 30 below Montana winter that was engulfing Father and the other Japanese men with him. Mother also packed tins of Christmas cookies for Mr. Toda and the minister's family at church, and for Mrs. Jameson, too. It was Yuki's task to deliver the cookies to the people at church on Sunday and on Christmas Eve to Mrs. Jameson. Yuki didn't like going to the parsonage at the back of the chapel because it was so dingy and always seemed to be in need of cleaning. The minister's three small children were usually underfoot, and his wife, with her bulging eyes and scratchy voice, made Yuki feel uncomfortable. This time she was lucky, for no one was around. She put the cookies on the kitchen table beside the stack of unwashed dishes, glanced at the sink full of dirty pans, and left quickly. She hurried then to the dormitory building to look for Mr. Toda. He had a separate room and kitchen. Page 27. Upstairs. But whenever Yuki had something for him, she just hollered from the bottom of the dark, narrow stairs, and he came creaking down to get whatever she had. "Thank you, Yuki-chan," he said, bowing as he accepted the gift. "You are very kind." "It was Mama who made the cookies," Yuki explained, wanting to give proper credit for Mother's efforts. Mr. Toda nodded. "I know," he said, "but I thank you for bringing them to me." He was very proper and careful to treat Yuki as a person and not just a child. The tin Yuki liked most to deliver was the one for Miss Jameson. Her house was warm and cozy and full of wonderful scents of dried rose petals and spices. She usually made a cup of hot cocoa for Yuki whenever she came to visit and then got out something from her bulging closet to show her. Sometimes it was her husband's stamp or shell collection. He had been the captain of a freighter, and had collected stamps and shells from all over the world. Sometimes Mrs. Jameson brought out her jewelry box full of precious stones and rings and bracelets and brooches that the captain had bought for her in Algiers or Istanbul or Lisbon. Yuki loved the jewelry box best. "Golly, Mrs. Jameson," she said when she first saw the jewels, "you're rich. You've got the jewels of a queen." Mrs. Jameson laughed the high, lilting laugh that her parent used to imitate. "My greatest wealth is my friends, dear Yuki," she said. "Jewels are a cold comfort on a rainy winter night." On this Christmas Eve, when Yuki appeared with her Christmas cookies, Mrs. Jameson seemed sad and withdrawn. Yuki, page 28, could see that she hadn't even bothered to tint her flaming red hair that usually blossomed around her head like a flowering spring hat. "Come in, come in," she said, and then went without even waiting for Yuki to sit down. She gave her a small package. "Open it," she urged. "It's something I want you to keep to remember me by." Yuki opened the gift quickly and discovered one of the pearl rings from Mrs. Jameson's jewelry box. "But Mrs. Jameson," Yuki said, astonished, "this is one of your best rings." "I know," Mrs. Jameson said softly. "I want you to have it so you won't ever forget me." It was almost as though Mrs. Jameson was trying to say goodbye. "Why?" Yuki asked. "You aren't going away, are you?" Mrs. Jameson shook her head. No, I would never leave this house, but you people, Yuki. Surely you've read the papers and heard the rumors. They say, well, it's terrible what they're saying."
"You mean about the evacuation?" Yuki said.
Mrs. Jameson nodded. "It is a ghastly thought, but what are we to do? I've already sent off two letters to President Roosevelt, but I fancy he's not much inclined to listen to me."
So Mrs. Jameson believed it would happen too, just as Ken did.
"Mother says they'd never do a thing like that," Yuki said, gravely. "Besides, Ken and I are citizens."
"I know," Mrs. Jameson said gently. "I wish that could make a difference."
Page 29. Her voice trailed off into silence, and there didn't seem to be much more to say. Yuki left her house feeling sad and puzzled. She held tightly the box with Mrs. Jameson's pearl ring and wondered, as she crossed the street, whether it was indeed going to be a farewell gift. By January, there was no more doubt in anyone's mind. Even Mother no longer insisted that the evacuation was impossible, and her friends at church urged her to begin packing and clearing out their house. On February 19, 1942, President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued an executive order authorizing the Secretary of War and his military commanders to prescribe areas from which any or all persons could be excluded. "That means the entire West Coast," Ken said flatly. "And all persons means us, the Japanese." It was strange, Yuki thought, that the United States should be at war with Italy and Germany, too, but that it was only the Japanese who were considered so dangerous to the country. "It doesn't seem fair," she objected to Ken. "The papers say it's for our own safety," Mother explained, trying to find some logical reason for such an illogical act. Ken shrugged. "I'd rather take a chance and have the choice of being free," he said firmly. "Me too," Yuki added. But then, of course, no one had asked their opinion.